What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, Steve Bannon walked out of the White House on Friday and headed straight back to Breitbart News. Will he use the alt-right megaphone to help the president who's just dismissed him or to hurt him? And will Steve Bannon at Breitbart be more powerful than Steve Bannon in the White House? It's Monday, August 21st. Jeremy Peters, where does the story of Breitbart and Steve Bannon begin?
Michael, it starts when Andrew Breitbart, the founder of Breitbart News and its namesake, died in 2012.
Okay.
Andrew Breitbart and Steve Bannon were partners in crime before Andrew's death. Steve served as kind of an informal editor, whisperer to Andrew before he took on any type of official capacity with Breitbart.
And what had Breitbart News been under Andrew Breitbart, and what did it become under Steve Bannon?
So Breitbart under Breitbart was more oriented toward gotcha videos. You'll remember that it was the place where a woman by the name of Shirley Sherrod, who was a Department of Agriculture employee, was filmed saying what appeared to be very disparaging things about white people and her refusal to help them when she was with the Department of Agriculture.
You know, the first time I was faced with having to help a white farmer save his farm, he took a long time talking, but he was trying to show me he was superior to me.
It turns out that that video had been selectively edited and left out some exculpatory information. It made Sherrod look a lot worse than she really was, and in fact twisted her words.
While he was taking all that time trying to show me he was superior to me, was I was trying to decide this how much help I was going to give him.
So after Andrew dies and Steve takes over, the site really begins to take up certain political causes that are rallying points for the Tea Party. And one of the big ones, of course, was the unseating of Eric Cantor.
Begin, though, with the major political upset for one of the most powerful Republicans in the country, Eric Cantor, the number two GOP lawmaker in the House, beaten in the primary by a Tea Party candidate.
And under Bannon, Breitbart really becomes more of a weapon for the Tea Party conservatives, the anti-establishment conservatives who want to unseat and defeat Republican Party leadership.
Yep, that's right. Cantor lost to David Brad, a political unknown. Cantor was widely thought to be the next Speaker of the House.
Breitbart, under Steve Bannon's direction, became one of the only media outlets paying any attention to this little-known economics professor named Dave Brat, who was running in a primary challenge that everyone expected Brat to lose.
How much of an upset is this? Cantor is the first person in American history to lose his primary while holding the position of House Majority Leader.
It had gone from being on the bottom rung of the conservative media food chain to suddenly being capable of taking out the majority leader of the House of Representatives. So it becomes an enormously powerful weapon for the Tea Party right, especially as it begins to coalesce around opposing issues like immigration reform.
Right.
Breitbart had a huge role in publicizing what it saw as this shady, corrupt, backroom deal that sellout moderate Republicans were making with Democrats in the Senate in 2013 to pass an immigration bill. And this would have been, had it passed both houses of Congress, the most significant immigration reform legislation in years and years.
The sponsors that are producing legislation for us today
will not say, amazingly, how many people they expect to enter into our country if their bill passes. Why not? You don't know, or you won't say.
But because of resistance from the right and from players like Breitbart, it never got off the ground.
This is legislation that is a flawed legislation, fatally flawed, and it should not become law. It just not. It shouldn't.
And I think we've told this story before on The Daily. Steve Bannon starts to work with then-Senator Jeff Sessions, who is an outspoken opponent of making it easier for illegal immigrants to stay in this country. And Sessions' aide at the time, Stephen Miller, and like bells should be going off in people's heads here, to block this comprehensive immigration reform.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, I remember the first time I ever met Stephen Miller was because Steve Bannon had suggested that I call him. He said, hey, call up this guy who works for Jeff Sessions. He's really smart. He knows immigration policy cold. He'll be a big asset to you. So even back in 2013-14, Bannon had forged a relationship with Jeff Sessions. Bannon and Sessions and Steve Miller were in the thick of it together in this fight.
Right. So all of this sets in motion, Steve Bannon, Jeff Sessions, and Stephen Miller coming together with Donald Trump, whose campaign at this point is, as I recall, kind of on the rocks.
Yeah.
And they all start to see Donald Trump as the candidate who can best embody these policies they have, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Steve's affinity for Donald Trump was that Donald Trump was arguably the most anti-establishment politician you had running for the presidency in a generation. And
they were laughing at me when I was saying, hey, this guy Trump is going to be, this is going to be very serious. So it's good to see that you're in the heat of combat now.
Well, you know, I remember that well.
Trump would occasionally go on Bannon's Breitbart News radio show.
Especially because I'd always mess up my hair when I put those big microphones around. You know, you'd always put them on. So I'd mess up my hair, which is fine. But I remember that you looked and you said, boy, those are big crowds you're getting. You have more than anybody else by far. I said, Steve, I'm telling you, just watch. And, you know, now we're getting, I mean, we had 20,000 in Dallas.
Bannon always kind of had his eye on Trump as a figure people were underestimating politically.
You know, we've had a lot of fun talking about very negative subjects because everything is negative with the country, Steve. I mean, there's nothing good happening. There's nothing positive happening. We don't win anymore. So,
if there's one reason that Bannon and Trump really hit it off, it was because they both shared this disgust for people who had been telling each of them all of their lives that they weren't going to be taken seriously. And they both kind of harbored and nursed these grudges that the elite institutions that they kind of operated at the periphery of, or sometimes from inside, Steve Bannon's case, Harvard, Goldman Sachs, Donald Trump's case, you know, New York society, the Ivy League, they never really felt a part of it. They never really felt comfortable in their own skin within these rarefied worlds. And they both shared kind of a disdain for the people who felt like those worlds were theirs and theirs alone.
Now, how did the destruction of the American financial system, the world financial system, and the American political system take place? Tell me, how did that happen? When the biggest enemies we've had in the last 100 years, the Nazis, the communists, the fascists, Imperial Japan, even Osama bin Laden, not one of our enemies could ever destroy our financial and political system. Much they couldn't even imagine it. How did it happen? Quite easily. In the last 20 years, our financial elites and the political class have taken care of themselves and led our country to the brink of ruin.
I guess it's important to note here that another thing that binds these two men, Steve Bannon and Donald Trump, is that they view the Republican Party with immense suspicion, and yet they're using the Republican Party as a vehicle to try to get Donald Trump elected. It's really kind of a complicated thing happening.
Right, and it becomes ultimately, I think, more than just a vehicle to get Donald Trump elected. It becomes a vehicle to dismantle the Republican Party. Only operating from within inside it are you able to really defeat it.
I think the big surprise is whether we're watching a switcheroo, one of the biggest ever in politics.
So almost exactly a year ago today, you have the situation where Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign manager, is found, after a New York Times report, to have concealed this income from Ukrainian sources. That's hugely problematic for him. Trump reads this in the New York Times, gets furious, and ends up shaking up his whole campaign team.
He's been basically forced out by two people coming in now who come in from the so-called dark side of politics, who are expected to make Trump even more abrasive and more pugilistic. And
bringing in Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway to run the show. And they are largely credited with helping the Trump campaign develop a level of focus in the final 2.5 months that allowed Trump to win. More than just keeping Trump focused and as on message as you can keep Donald Trump, Steve brought a level of ruthlessness to the campaign's attacks on Hillary Clinton, which were already pretty savage.
Donald Trump just dropped a new element into the pre-debate atmosphere with a little more than an hour to go before tonight's event.
It was Steve Bannon whose idea it was to bring out the accusers of Bill Clinton.
From left to right, Kathleen Willey, Juanita Broderick, then Donald Trump in the middle, Paula Jones.
Bannon brings them to a presidential debate. Right. He wants to seat them in Trump's guest box, where they will be right next to Bill and Chelsea Clinton.
The key point that Donald Trump has been trying to make on Twitter and has been trying to use Breitbart News, which is a conservative news outlet, the head of which or former head of which is effectively running Trump's campaign. They've been all day long pushing out the notion that...
And they hold a press conference before the debate. And in the back of that room where the press conference is being held, there are pictures of Steve Bannon smiling this ear-to-ear grin. He is just absolutely thrilled at what he's pulled off.
Mr. Trump may have said some bad words, but Bill Clinton raped me and Hillary Clinton threatened me. I don't think there's any comparison.
So, Jeremy, let's fast forward to the White House. Donald Trump is elected with Steve Bannon as a top advisor and guide throughout the campaign, and you have Bannon, Sessions, and Miller all constituting a nationalist faction inside the administration. And that in some ways, this group of nationalists is extremely effective when they get to the White House in setting an agenda, and in others, they almost derail the first year of the presidency, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they are responsible, of course, for one of the biggest and earliest missteps of the Trump presidency, which is its first travel ban, which blocked people from mostly Muslim countries from entering the United States. Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller were responsible for seeing this through, and it kept getting kicked down by the courts. What they would say they are proud of achieving, I think, most of all, is the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accords, which it perfectly fits with Steve Bannon's worldview that the United States should not be beholden to the interests of other nations.
The Paris Agreement handicaps the United States economy in order to win praise from the very foreign capitals and global activists that have long sought to gain wealth at our country's expense. They don't put America first. I do, and I always will.
So, Jeremy, I want to come back to where we started, where in a sense Bannon started, and where he returns, which is to Breitbart News. So let's just dissect a few of the things that have happened in the past couple of days. First, an editor at Breitbart, shortly after the news is announced, tweets the word war. And then Bannon goes back to Breitbart, presides over a meeting, and offers this very intriguing quote, that the Trump presidency that we fought for and won is over. What does that mean?
I mean, Breitbart was always kind of weaponized media. As far as pro-Trump conservatives were concerned, it was their tool, you know, kind of their hammer with which to bludgeon the Republican establishment. I think now it becomes this heat-seeking missile directed straight at Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. I think what Steve sees happening in his ideal world is a party that emerges from Donald Trump's presidency that is neither Republican nor Democrat. I think he, if you were to ask him, and I've heard him say this before, he thinks that the Republican Party is basically done as an institution.
The establishment, and particularly the Republican establishment, has no interest in making the fundamental changes in this country that we have to do in order to save our country.
He's somebody who has these grand theories of societal, cultural destruction and rebirth.
What we need to do is bitch slap the Republican Party.
And he sees the Republican Party as if not American society or the world at large in the throes of a great crisis from which it will have to reinvent itself.
And if we have to, we'll take it over.
Is Breitbart poised to be even stronger than ever now with a leader who helped elect the president and enact a nationalist agenda in the White House? Is Bannon better equipped now to reshape the Republican Party? When we started this conversation, you said that that was an overriding goal of his, to turn this party inside out, maybe even blow it up. Is he more able to do that on the outside of Breitbart than he was inside the White House?
I think to a certain extent, yes. He will be unshackled in a way that, for instance, frees him from having to pretend like he cares about working with Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, which as the president's chief strategist, he had to do inside the White House. Right. Now he's able to attack them and question their conservative credentials and their commitment to Trump's agenda and energize and mobilize a very rowdy and passionate part of the conservative base. The ultimate success for Steve Bannon having now left the White House will be if he is able to completely obliterate the leadership structure of the Republican Party and replace it with something that more closely aligns with his conservative, nationalistic, America first view of policy. And where all the energy is right now is with the Trump wing of the party. And I think that if Steve Bannon comes out of 2018 with a Republican Party in tatters, he'll consider that to be a victory because it'll just be one step closer to what he sees as his goal of entirely remaking it into a party devoted more to economic nationalism.
The party of Donald Trump. Maybe even a new party.
Maybe call it the Trump Independence Party, but I think that's where Steve sees us headed. Donald Trump as the catalyst for shattering the Republican Party as we know it and becoming kind of a figurehead around which a new party develops.
We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's what else you need to know today.
What we know is that resistance is not something you say, it's something you do.
Tens of thousands of protesters across the country came out this weekend to demonstrate against racism, white supremacy, and Nazism, 1 week after the violence in Charlottesville.
And we're going to stand up for each other because we know what it's like to walk alone. If you're black, if you're brown, if you're queer, if you're a woman.
On Saturday, President Trump tweeted that he wanted to applaud the protesters in Boston, the site of the biggest demonstration, saying they were, quote, speaking out against bigotry and hate. Our country will soon come together as one, he said. Our great country has been divided for decades. Sometimes you need protest in order to heal, and we will heal and be stronger than ever before. And the first total coast-to-coast solar eclipse in nearly a century occurs today. It will begin in Oregon around 10:15 a.m. West Coast time and end in South Carolina around 2:49 p.m. East Coast time. Along the course of the eclipse, known as the Path of Totality, the sun will appear to be completely blotted out by the moon, with only a thin corona of light visible. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.